This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Resolute Square.
There was also maintained what was called an enemies list, which is rather extensive and continually being updated.
Democrats want Republicans dead.
Where I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and I wouldn't lose any voters, okay?
The women with the least likelihood of getting pregnant are the ones most worried about having abortions.
On January 6th of 2021, you had tens of thousands of people peacefully protesting.
No, it's not a right-wing conspiracy theory. It's not QAnon. It's real.
I'm Rick Wilson, and this is The Enemies List. Our guest today on The Enemies List is Jonathan Taplin. Jonathan is a terrific author, and he has written a new book that I think is enormously valuable. I read it in essentially one sitting over a long weekend day. It's called The End of Reality, How 4 Billionaires Are Selling a Fantasy Future of the Metaverse, Mars, and Crypto. And he goes into the history here, folks, and the activities in the psyche in a lot of ways of four big names. A couple of them you really do know. One of them you might not know as much. Peter Thiel, Mark Zuckerberg, Mark Andreessen, and Elon Musk. And just how pernicious the flip side of all the shiny technology that these guys have been involved with in the last several decades has been for our society and for our country. So with that, Jonathan, thank you so, so much for joining us on The Enemies List today. I really appreciate your time. Welcome to the show.
Good to be here, Rick. I'm a longtime fan of yours, and so I'm proud to be here.
I appreciate that. So talk to me about how you decided to write this particular history of these particular four players in Silicon Valley.
Well, I've been a critic of big tech for quite a while. I wrote a book called Move Fast and Break Things in 2015. That was really concerned about how the effect of social network was having on both people's psyche and our democracy. But then I began to realize that the supposed libertarian mentality of big tech was turning into something much more authoritarian. And that really worried me. I mean, first, Thiel, of course, financed the far right guys like Blake Masters and J.D. Vance. And you know, if you're a libertarian and your candidates want to make sure that women don't have any liberty, that's a pretty kind of weird psychic battle that you
narrow,
have to...
It's a narrow version of liberty.
Yeah, you have to figure that out. And I read a quote that said, democracy's assassins always need accomplices. And then I came to the conclusion that Elon and Zuckerberg, and of course, as you know, both Thiel and Andreessen were investors, the earliest investors in Facebook.
Right.
These are all the assassins, accomplices, you know. I mean, Trump, as you've argued for a long time, couldn't have come to where he came without social media. And so what then loomed over the horizon was my realization that these four people had a very different vision of the future than I do. I mean, I believe that technology can serve us incredibly to get over some of the problems. I've seen 3D houses built in 24 hours in Austin, Texas by a great new firm, you know, called Icon. I've seen amazing things happen with solar and wind energy and all of that. But their view of the future is very different, and that is one in which AI and robots will pretty much dominate everything that's going to happen. And as Sam Altman said, he said that Sam Altman is the CEO of OpenAI, a ChatGPT owner, said he expected the marginal cost of intelligence to fall close to zero within 10 years as AI takes over more and more jobs. Mm-hmm. The earning power of many, many workers would be drastically reduced in that scenario. It would reduce, result in a transfer of wealth from labor to the owners of capital and the owners of the AI system, so dramatic that it could be remedied only by a massive countervailing redistribution known as universal basic income. Now, I think, wise enough to know that, you know, our new Senate Majority Leader has no interest in universal basic income. No interest.
No.
and none of his compatriots do. So, you know, it would probably only be when the pitchfork brigades are outside their house at 40% unemployment that maybe they might consider that. But until then, we're in a techno-deterministic world in which we're assuming that Elon and Mark and Andreessen and Thiel have our best interests at heart and are leading us in a direction that could benefit us. But that's not true. They have only their own interests at heart. And quite frankly, they're kind of thrilled with the gridlock and chaos that happens in Washington, because it will assure that they never get taxed and they never get regulated.
That's a very interesting point that somebody asked yesterday, like, why is it that nobody's ever regulated TikTok or Facebook? I'm like, because they know the marginal cost of hiring 1,000 lobbyists is rounding error for what would happen if they got actually regulated or if there were actually any sort of taxation or liability for any of the things that they do. I want to break these guys down one at a time a little bit. And I want to start with Peter Thiel, who's, in my mind, one of the darkest of these characters, because Thiel believes in some very strange shit. I don't think Thiel has any belief in democracy or constitutional republic or any. I think he is a guy who is essentially sort of a techno-monarchist in a weird way. And he is having a big impact on American life in terms of being so involved in politics and in funding these lawsuits against the media to try to break any institutional power that would oppose people like him.
Not only is he having that kind of influence, but he's having that kind of influence on the other three gentlemen in this thing. In other words, he has brought them over to his view of the world in ways that, if you've read Mark Andreessen's screed last week, you know,
I read it, is
scary. He quotes a bunch of fascists and he basically says, anybody who opposes us, technology is going to kill people. So Thiel's point of view is democracy and freedom are not compatible. I mean, democracy and capitalism are not compatible.
Right.
And he told the Wall Street Journal that only 2% of the people in America know what's going on. That's the venture capitalists and the scientists. And everybody else is like a sheep. And so that's his view of the world. And he would basically like his best friend, Curtis Yarvin, to have a king. He didn't want a president. He wants a king. And then he has these totally screwball ideas that, you know, he doesn't want to die. So he thinks he can live to 200. So he goes down to San Diego once a month to get blood transfusions from 15-year-olds because in his laboratory at Methuselah, that's what his lab is called.
Right.
The old mice that got blood transfusions from young mice live longer than the old mice that don't get blood transfusions. So he's sure it's going to work for him, and he's gonna live to 200.
Well, you know, you mentioned Curtis Yarvin, who folks for years blogged as a guy under the name Mencius Moldberg or Moldbug or something like that.
Yeah.
And this is a guy who's sort of the intellectual founder of the alt-right in a lot of ways, isn't he?
Totally.
He's very racially aware, to put it as mildly as I can, and really post-American liberty. They don't believe in that. They don't believe in that our system should be preserved at all.
Well, Curtis wants to put everybody who doesn't kind of swear fealty to Donald Trump or something in essentially a prison camp. And then if they show that they're really good and at least put ankle bracelets on them so we know where they are and we can arrest them quickly. And then when they swear fealty to Donald Trump or whoever the ruler of the right is, they can get their ankle bracelet taken off.
Considering that Peter Thiel's firm Planeteer is one of the largest private intelligence gathering operations in the world, and that they collect data at scale on every human being on the planet, you might not have to have an actual physical ankle bracelet. They'll just know where and who you are by where your phone is and punish you that way.
Peter Thiel's Palantir gets all of its money from government. These people call themselves libertarians, but they're actually crony capitalists.
Oh, God, yeah.
Elon Musk, every flight of SpaceX is paid for by you and me, the taxpayer, and Elon takes a 25% VIG off the top of those flights for himself. And, you know, as for Starlink, U.S. government pays for Starlink to give the Ukrainians some kind of satellite connectivity, but Elon still retains the ability to turn it off when it gets too close to Russia.
When his friends from Russia get on the phone and go, hey, can you help us out?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. He's had a very big impact. The Gawker lawsuit has made Thiel somebody that reporters don't want to really cover. They don't really want to write about him. They don't really want to poke the bear. Did you have any sense of that when you were writing about him? Did the Gawker thing sort of enter your brain at all when you were thinking about writing about Thiel?
Well, my academic colleagues, you know, were always more worried for me and my safety than I was. And maybe I'm just naive or I'm a child of the 60s and, you know, kind of old enough to not care. But it's not only that he continues to believe that harassing the media will be useful in every way. So he thinks that, you know, he has a new fund in which he's raised money specifically to hold the media accountable. And that means, again, probably more lawsuits and more threats. I mean, after all, Donald, who he loves, says the media is the enemy of the people. So that says it all.
We do sort of think a lot of the time that these masters of the universe in the tech world, that the momentum of their money and the scope of their ideas is so powerful that they can't fail. But I would make an argument, and I'd love to get your thoughts on this, is Zuckerberg's metaverse idea, the idea that we were going to spend 8 hours a day with a big headset on in a virtual world created by Mark Zuckerberg with a bunch of cartoonishly animated avatars, that does not seem to be grabbing people's attention at the same level that he thought it would be. He's invested a couple of billion. Well, I'm sorry. I think like 12 billion into this, and it doesn't seem to be going anywhere.
You know, they have a metric called the dog fooding thing, which basically is their ability to monitor how many people are in Horizon, their metaverse world. And it's very right. clear the dogs ain't eating the dog food. You know, they're
yeah.
just not.
It's the old rule. You can't sell good dog food, bad dog food with good PR.
Right. And so, you know, he's now resorting to kind of advertising as a way to train doctors or something like that. You know, in other words, who would think that you would want a thing that covers your eyes unless you were kind of on the spectrum and didn't want anybody to look in your eyes, you know? And right. as for the avatars, they're not even giving you legs in the metaverse.
That's
you
right.
have just a trunk that floats
you're like
around.
A floating blob with no legs.
Right. But I mean, you can buy Gucci clothing for your avatar.
Well, that is a relief. I had no idea. I'm signing up now.
At ridiculously high prices. And, you know, one of the things the social scientists have found that Zuckerberg calls it aspirational avatars. So people get to design their own avatar of how they look, right? And there's whole sites that basically you can borrow Kim Kardashian's body, or you can borrow Chris Hemsworth's body. And so then it turns out the social sciences says that if you meet online in the metaverse, nobody wants to actually meet in real life. Because
right, it becomes too much of an expectations game.
A reality check.
I was prepping for this show, and a friend of mine, I was telling him, I was going to interview you, and he goes, "We're talking about Zuckerberg and the metaverse. What a big flop it's been." And he said, "You know, the irony of this thing is it flopped 15 years ago with Second Life when it kicked off the first time, or longer than that now, probably."
Right.
It fascinates me that he thinks that that is the way to keep human attention and take a cut of ad sales in that space. Because as Scott Galloway points out, you know, people carry an iPhone or wear AirPods because they are status symbols for the billion most creative people in the world and all that, the, you know, wealthiest Western, blah, blah, blah. But no one views wearing a huge visor on your face as a status symbol. No one thinks of wearing a giant goon headset as a way to attract someone else, to persuade them to join you in your life or your business or professional practice at all. It's just, it's so, I do think that's the one guy in this story who comes across to me as almost a little tragic, because, you know, Zuckerberg obviously is a very broken guy. This idea that he was going to build a little world where he was the cool kid, it almost makes you kind of like feel for the guy.
He's not backing down. That's the weird thing, you know. And,
right.
And quite frankly, this comes from this vision that I talked to you earlier about with Sam Altman, which would be that in the future, millions of people would be sitting home in their pajamas all day. And today, they're playing video games. And a colleague of mine at Princeton named Angus Deaton has written a book called Deaths of Despair. And basically, it's a portrait of people who maybe have a disability, they got hurt at work, and then the factory leaves town, and they're left alone in their house. They've got their disability payment, and they spend their money on video games and maybe OxyContin for their disability, their pain in their back, and eventually they kill themselves. And the statistics are frightening. They're almost as bad as the statistics of teenage self-harm because of Instagram
Right.
So, look, these guys are disconnected from the reality that you and I live in. They generally are supreme narcissists surrounded by people who are afraid to pierce what someone called, you know, the reality distortion field. You know, the idea that the Elon says, I'm going to go to Mars and it's only going to cost $10 trillion and we're going to do it. And nobody wants to tell him that's the stupidest idea I've ever heard, you know.
Andreessen in this whole mess, and again, like I said, I think Zuckerberg almost comes across as tragic because he just doesn't, his anxieties are so internalized where the rest of them, their anxieties have like been foisted on the rest of the world. So I want to talk a little bit about Andreessen. And he and I used to like interact on Twitter years ago, pretty friendly. He blocked me. I don't know. I never knew why. I don't know. Trump probably. His space in your story is the desire to be like a crypto baron. And I think one of the things that you mentioned, it's like the idea that crypto is some broadly small d democratic financial liberation scheme for everybody in the world is horseshit. It's mostly held by a bunch of guys like Mark Andreessen, and they're playing the market.
So Scott Galloway pointed out in the fall of 2021, 95% of the Bitcoin was held by 2% of the holders. So what did they do? They organize a advertising campaign and put in $300 million to advertise FTX and crypto.com. Right. And they buy a bunch of naming rights and big sports arenas, and they just spend, you know, $1 billion at the end of the day to get everybody to believe, and they get LeBron and they get Tom Brady and Matt Damon and Larry David and all these people to say, you got to be in crypto if you're cool, you know? And so if you look at what happens on every football game from about November 10th, 2021 through the Super Bowl of 2022, 60% of the advertising was for crypto. There was so much advertising on the Super Bowl for crypto that they, Madison Avenue ended up calling it the Crypto Bowl, right? So at this point, Bitcoin was at $61,000 a coin. And the suckers flooded in, the whales, as, you know, Scott Galloway has called them, were happy to sell their coins at $61,000. You know, because they got them all for almost nothing at the very beginning. And by April, Bitcoin was down to 19,000 a coin. So everybody who came in lost their shirt. And the same thing with Andreessen's other big scam, which was called NFTs. He had a platform called OpenSea. And in the fall of 2021, you could go on OpenSea, and for $50,000, you could buy a Bored Ape, which you were assured was an original painting made by a machine, but it was original painting. You had the only one. They would give you a digital certificate. There was nothing. There was no Bored Ape like your Bored Ape. The Wall Street Journal reported last week that of the 280,000 people. Closer to 2 million people who bought these Bored Apes. Today, they can't sell them for 50 cents.
Correct.
They bought them for $50,000 and they can't give them away today. So it was a total scam.
The ultimate pyramid scheme of our time is not Bernie Madoff. It's the Bitcoin bros.
Right.
It has no functional store of value purpose other than to enrich these guys. And it's like somebody asked me one time, like I was out in Vegas one time not too long ago, and a friend of mine, you go on the tables. I'm like, no, I can do math.
Right.
I can do math. Why aren't you doing Bitcoin? I can do math.
Right. Right.
It's a Ponzi scheme, guys. It does not work otherwise. Right. And look, Andreessen, one more thing on Andreessen. You mentioned his screed he wrote last week. You know, and there were I read it twice actually, because I honestly think of myself as a techno optimist in some ways too. I approach technology from my background as a genuine classical liberal with some libertarian leanings, but not in the shitty way, as I like to say. And I always believed that one of the things technology could do was empower people in places where freedom of communication was denied. It could empower people to leverage technology to make their lives better. And there were a couple pieces in there. Like he talked about energy and the need to like diversify our ways we generate energy in the country and to make it cheaper and more broadly available to everybody. I love that. But there was so much of it that came across like 1979 dorm room bullshit session, you know, of people that just that have lived in a bubble. And like I your life is so easy, dude. You can't imagine like you're playing chess with people's lives when your life will never have a moment of hardship in it ever again.
Absolutely.
And it just that's what struck me about it. And the sort of like disconnect from the reality of human experience and human values and the disconnect from the world people really live in. I mean, if you're talking about the top 50,000 income earners in the country, yeah, he's probably right. It's going to be great for them. And it's not capitalism. It's not capitalism. It's not free markets. This relies on, as you said, these guys get like special regulatory consideration, special tax consideration, special liability consideration. And that brings me to Elon, who I have complicated feelings about because I, like anybody who has
what I call the demonic energy. And I kind of have that myself. I'm not a guy who gets a lot of, I don't rest a lot. I don't slow down a lot. And I see that in him and I'm like, he's got hustle at least. But too much of that hustle is lost in the shuffle of he's made his money on three gigantic government giveaways. Tesla would not exist. And the fact that they've been capitalized by using the energy, the renewable energy tax credits, it's paid for by the American taxpayer at scale. And Tesla was the thing that empowered almost all the other scams after it.
And don't forget, Obama gave them $480 million in the middle of the meltdown, the 2008, when they were about to go bankrupt.
That's correct.
So he totally saved their bacon, and as you point out, if they couldn't sell their tax credits to GM and Ford, they wouldn't make any profit. But think about SpaceX. SpaceX's only customer is NASA. So you and I, the taxpayers, pay for everything, and now he wants us to give him $10 trillion. To go to Mars, which with no reasoning as to why we should do that, you know, other than we should be a multi-planet species.
Yeah, look, I'm a space kid. I grew up around the space program. I grew up in Florida in the 60s. All that, right? I love aviation and space stuff. Love it. And I think the machines that SpaceX has built are magnificent technological achievements. They really, really are. They are both the Falcon 9, the Falcon Heavy, and Starship. They are magnificent technological achievements. But nobody should fool themselves that this was Elon scrapping money together at a bake sale to build these things.
No.
This is a guy who has very skillfully played the game of leveraging government contracts. And, you know, did the incumbents in the space field leave a gap where he could exploit it? 100% they did. But it's not just this swaggering capitalist success story.
And now he's the monopolist. He's the only provider.
Well, yeah. I mean, and that's true. There's a point of this of like the other companies, the ULA, the United Launch Alliance, all the other, and Boeing and everybody else who wanted to be in the launch game, they were comfortable for 50 years and they just managed to squander all of it when he came in with a marginal improvement on the technology at first. And look, I love Mars. I love the idea of interplanetary travel, but throwing $10 trillion at it in the next 10 years does not seem like an economically sensible idea at any level.
So I went out to JPL, which has, of course, had rovers on Mars for 12 years, right? And the guy that ran the rover program said to me, "Well, you know, there's an old saying in NASA, no Buck Rogers, no bucks.
No bucks, no bucks, right. Right.
So meaning that if you didn't have some brave astronaut like John Glenn that you could bring back and put in a parade down New York, you know, Broadway, you weren't going to get congressional funding. And so he said, look, we've been had a hard time getting money to put these rovers, and the rovers are getting better every time we put one up there, and they do everything that a human could do. They dig the dirt, they put the dirt in the sampler, they analyze it, they send the information back to Earth. There's no point in putting a human up there.
It's a great adventure, but the idea is that the trick of the adventure is that he wants to be the monopoly provider and use everybody's tax dollars to do that great adventure. And look, I'm all for great adventures. I think there's a much greater chance of commercializing the moon in the short term. Everybody's going to try it. It's in the neighborhood. And look, like I said, I'm not taking a thing away from the thing that, not Elon, by the way, everybody, just so you know, Elon is not a rocket engineer. He is not an aerospace engineer. He's not an engineer, period.
No.
He is a manager and a front guy. The brilliant people at SpaceX have built magnificent, astounding rockets. I've watched them develop these things. They're brilliant technological artifacts, and they're useful, and they're great for, you know, what we need for access to space.
but it's not going to be a libertarian space colony on Mars with President Elon, folks.
Right.
It's just not going to be that way.
King Elon.
So, and I obviously we can't talk about Elon without talking about the white hot shit show disaster that is Twitter. Talk to me about your reporting on this, because it's fascinating.
First off, Twitter and the Twitter acquisition may go down and be taught at Harvard Business School as one of the worst financial transactions in the 21st century. Today, Bloomberg reported that there's 13% fewer users each day on Twitter than there were a year ago. Advertising has dropped by 67%. In terms of getting people to sign up for an account, one of those verified account, 1% of the users have signed up for a verified account. And they're mostly the trolls who want their trolling to be amplified, which is what Elon promised you.
As a guy who spent a lot of time on Twitter over the last, God knows, 10 years, 12 years, whatever it is now, the character change of Twitter when he amplified the paid trolls is frankly insane. It is so vastly unpalatable now. And there's a reason people are leaving in droves. They can't abide all of the ugliness. But I mean, look, who knew that if you let accounts back on Twitter like Hitler fan 1488 and, you know, white power is great 666, that people would run away? Who knew?
Right. But you know, Elon has this classic shoot the messenger thing. So he calls out the Anti-Defamation League for pointing out to advertisers that it's filled with anti-Semites. You know, and they're creating a complete clusterfuck. And Elon says, they're trying to ruin my business. Well, he's the one that let Kanye West and all the neo-Nazis back on the platform. And he's unwilling to take responsibility for that.
Yeah, I think that's right. And his idea that you're going to fire the trust and safety people, charge people to be on the platform. I mean, look, there's an argument to be made that he wants to like crash the system so that he can devalue his debt on it and try to walk away from that. I wonder if you think that part of this was Elon and that sort of red pill, tech bro, alt-right crowd really thinking that they were going to make a play here that was going to change society, or if it was just a bad business deal that he just got too deep into.
He's got David Sachs, who's Peter Thiel's closest friend, as his advisor. Okay, so David Sachs was the guy that helped advise Peter Thiel on how to sue Gawker out of business. So I do believe that David Sachs thought, oh, now we've finally captured our own vehicle to spew our propaganda out to the world. The problem is that as a business, it's already dead, right? In other words, the $33 billion of equity, $26 billion of which was Elon's, is gone. It's wiped out. So all that's left is the $13 billion of debt, which is held by big banks.
And Saudi.
Yeah. And so they want him to buy it back, and he can't buy it. He can't buy it back.
Right.
And so it's just going to sit there. And, you know, at some point, the Fed will say to Morgan Stanley and all these other banks, you got to sell this debt because that's not your job to hold on to this forever. You're supposed to get it off your books. And then that's when the real crunch will come. And then maybe the debt holders take control of the company and Elon gets pushed out. And then the whole thing would have been for naught, you know. And that's
crazy.
That's the only outcome, having been an investment banker, a mergers and acquisition guy in the 80s, that's the only outcome I can see at this point.
Right. Well, I have to say, this is a group of people who are very much changing our world, very much influencing our culture, very much shaping our economy. And I'm really delighted, Jonathan, you came on the show today. Because I think there's sometimes it's easy to almost look at these guys as a little bit clownish. The truth of the matter is they're kind of dangerous at the end of the day. They're kind of more terrifying than amusing at the end of the day. So, well, again, thank you, Jonathan, for coming on the show. Folks, the book is The End of Reality: How Billionaires Are Selling a Fantasy Future of the Metaverse, Mars, and Crypto. It's Jonathan Taplin. It's available where all fine books are sold. Jonathan, thank you so much once again, and we will see you again soon.
Thanks, Rick. Appreciate it.
Thanks again for listening to The Enemies List. If you have any comments, questions, or if there's someone you'd like to hear on the podcast, hit me up on Twitter at TheRickWilson. Thanks again for the wonderful support you've shown the pod. We're growing fast. It really helps if you will share this with your friends, your family, and anyone else who, like us, is trying to save democracy. While you're at it, if you could rate and review the podcast, I would be very much appreciative. I know this is the sort of thing you've heard a billion times. Please rate, review, like, blah, blah, blah. But you need to do it. It really does help us a lot. We are slaves to the algorithm, my friends. And if you do this, it will help get the pod out further. Anyway, thanks again for listening. I'll see you next time. And remember, whatever you do, stay off the list.